Mr. Robertson, if you could introduce item 19.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. This item follows on our December meeting Basin Plan Triennial Review List item. As part of approving the Triennial Review List in December, the Board determined sustainable water resource management is the top Basin Plan amendment priority. The Board also discussed some of the challenges of staffing, where will the resources come from. We discussed a little bit. We still have to do some figuring. This item is intended more as a discussion and an initial listening session on our part for you to plant some seeds as we then go to a rough cut scope for this item. I want to reassure the Board that we will come back multiple times with this to you. So there is no need to feel like this is a one-shot opportunity. You got to get it in now. We'll probably run for 45 minutes maybe on this item, something like that. And then we'll take what we hear and come back at later point this year with a little more thought out scope of work there.
But yeah, and if I can, you know, further augment the comment from Mr. Robertson, also in managing our time availability, you know, we want to make sure that we end, reasonably at a reasonable time this afternoon. So this item, it's totally okay, you know, not to look at it as not being finished business. This is strictly a bit of a progress, and staff will take good notes, and then we'll be continuing this item later on. So just so if you can indulge me, I'm going to actually, to keep us on track, I'm going to ask to use the timer. So we'll know, you know, when we're at around 45 minutes.
Good.
And so if you could set the timer, that would be great. So thank you.
So just to be clear, my primary goals for today's discussion are stimulating discussion with the Board and comment from stakeholders. So in effect, this is our first listening session. Then additionally, reminding you, we'll take these ideas back and we'll compile them into something a little more like a scope of work, and we'll come back to you again before we implement. So with that, Michael and I are going to give you a brief presentation to tee up the discussion.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Board. Michael Thomas, Assistant Executive Officer. And we're going to talk a little bit about sustainable water management. Here's an image that we're used to seeing, and I want to try to get some perspective on the water that is available to us. Here's a different image that the USGS came up with. If you took all the water on planet Earth and put it into a sphere and set it on top of the United States, it would look like this to scale. That's all the water, all of the oceans, and all of the fresh water. But the vast majority of that water is not available to us. Most of it is salt water. The second sphere that you see there, hardly see it on this screen. It's kind of dark, but I think you can see it on yours. The second sphere there is non-salt water. So that is groundwater and fresh water. But most of that is not available to us. A lot of that is, a large percentage of it is locked up in icebergs and permafrost and things like that, and deep groundwater. That small dot right there is the fresh water that's readily available to us. Yes. This is just breaking it down further using percentages. The first column shows that 96% of the water on Earth is salt water. Of the fresh water that's available to us, it's about 2.5% of the total. Most of that, 68% of that, is in glaciers and ice caps. Groundwater is 30%, and surface water and other fresh water is 1.2%. And of that 1.2%, 69% of that is unavailable to us. It's ground ice and permafrost. We have very little of the total actually available to us. And as a reminder, Central Coast is very dependent on groundwater. This map of the Central Coast shows our groundwater basins and the priority of those basins according to the Department of Water Resources. The orange, dark orange, are high priority. The yellow are medium priority, and the green are lower priority. We have, as you can see, we have several high and medium priority basins. Groundwater supplies about 86% of all use in our region. This is the most dependent region in the state of California on groundwater. Many of our communities rely on groundwater for 100% of their supply.
Michael, I don't know if you included the Central Coast groundwater report that I forwarded to you. I was just going to add to that. In Santa Cruz County, which is the county with the most abundant surface water, 79% of the water used in Santa Cruz County is sourced from groundwater. So the county with the most abundant surface water. In Monterey County, 99% of water used is met by groundwater. And similar in San Luis Obispo County is 92%. All these numbers shift farther towards groundwater as we're in drought cycles, too. So as we talk about climate change, we're going to focus even more on this groundwater dependency. We're already vulnerable, and we're going to shift farther into that vulnerability.
This is a table that comes from the report John was talking about with the numbers on dependency on groundwater and surface water for different counties. The stressors that we mentioned in the staff report, the main stressors are climate change, population, and pollution. We have some maps in the staff report, and what we were trying to show there is that on the Central Coast, we have the most extreme conditions. They appear here first and spread to the rest of the state. And this happened during the previous drought. And you can see through this series of maps how that occurred. This is the final map that is in the staff report. It's from 1 month ago. And it shows that the Central Coast is still in moderate drought and abnormally dry conditions, like most of Southern California. But the more recent map that just came out, along with this headline in the San Luis Obispo Tribune newspaper, states the county whiplashes back into drought. And we are now, a portion of the Central Coast is now in severe drought, which seems to be centered on Santa Barbara persistently. And the moderate drought and abnormally dry conditions are spreading throughout the rest of the state. Pictures at Kachuma Lake in 2014 and again in 2016. Aerial view of Kachuma Lake 2001 and 2016. California population. The Department of Finance predicts that the population will increase from 39 million in 2016 to 51 million in 2060. As that population increases, it puts more of a demand on the state water supply and the communities on the Central Coast that rely on that supply. Another stressor is pollution. This is the Salinas Valley. We have major groundwater pollution problems in this area, as you're all well aware of. It's from irrigated agriculture is one source. Municipalities are another source, and saltwater intrusion is another source. A couple of maps just to illustrate the saltwater intrusion problem just south of us. The city of Castroville is here. And this map shows a sequence of saltwater intrusion over time. And this dark green area on the coast, that's in the 1940s. And over the decades, up until 2011, where this very dark area, dark red area, dark purple, shows where the seawater intrusion lens has moved inland. This is the 180-foot aquifer, and this is the 400-foot aquifer. And this is a problem not just in this area, but in many areas in our region along the coast. So one of the things that came up in the at the last board meeting was the scope of such a project. If we were to do a basin plan amendment, what would be the scope of a project and how do we get our heads around it? And what we are thinking right now is, in one sense, the scope would be the subjects that you include in the basin plan amendment. And we're thinking of the three basics: recycling, groundwater recharge, and pollution reduction. And in each one of these subjects, there are many sub-subjects. You know, and we'll be addressing as many of those as we can. So it seems like a short list, but that is actually a tremendous amount of work if we were to take this on. And the second way to think of scope is through implementation. The board has direct authority, indirect authority, and influence. And depending on how much of the amendment you want in the direct authority category, for example, would change the scope of the project. The more direct authority we try to establish, the more comprehensive the basin plan amendment and the necessary justification for it. To give some examples of what we are thinking about in terms of direct authority, that would be making sure that what we put in the basin plan is enforceable, that it includes requirements, enforceable requirements. And some examples of those are time schedule orders or a time schedule to reduce pollution and achieve water quality objectives, and prohibitions. Prohibitions are one of the most powerful things that the board can use, and there are prohibitions in the basin plan. Just recently, to give you an example, we are working on the Plains Pipeline oil spill, and the using just the water code and our normal penalty calculation. The maximum penalty that we could assess in that case is a little over $400,000. However, using the prohibition in the basin plan against oil spills in Santa Barbara County, the maximum fine is over $2 million. And that's what we are currently pursuing in that case. So there are many different ways that the board could use these types of requirements to achieve its goals. Indirect authority is kind of looking at it in the reverse, where the discharge is a privilege, not a right. And the board is not obligated to provide a permit for the discharge of waste. So the board could use its discretion in issuing permits. It could consider what local agencies are doing in terms of managing their water portfolio. If local agencies or entities are managing their water portfolio in a way that degrades water quality, the board could consider whether or not to issue a permit in those cases. And the third category is influence. And the main influence that we have there is in financing. The State Water Board issues hundreds of millions of dollars in grants and loans, hundreds of million in the Central Coast alone over the past few decades. And they rely on the regional board to some degree to prioritize and to make recommendations as to how those funds are distributed. We've had direct experience with this in many cases for very large projects. Cambria is one, Los Osos is another one. It includes getting grants in the first place or getting loans and the interest rate charged on those loans. So we've had a lot of influence over the years. And the board could expand on that.
Oh, I would bring to mind to add to that, most recently, City of San Luis Obispo, which is going in the directions that we want them to go or we want communities to go, and we helped accelerate their, at their request, helped accelerate their funding package through the Department of Financial Assurance or Assistance at State Board.
Another aspect of influence is establishing your expectations in the basin plan. And we then use that. That's the language we use in all of our permits, all of our orders, all of our letters, and all of our communications when we go to meet with and communicate with other entities. We can take that information and use it to influence other organizations and education as well. That's the scope that we are currently thinking about in terms of subjects and implementation. In conclusion, sustainable water management is critical to our future. I think this is one of the most important things the board will undertake in the next many years. If you look at the news, even today, it's not just here in California or around the Central Coast, but all around the world, we're experiencing these problems. You probably read about Cape Town in South Africa, a city of 4 million people, and their water supply is expected to run out. They are going to turn off taps in mid-April. It's 4 million people. And they're planning to bring in the military and set up watering stations where they're in survival mode. They only allow people enough water to survive. And they're using the military because they expect that the city is going to descend into anarchy. And there's a recent article in National Geographic that discusses this and what other areas around the world and other cities are heading in the same direction. And there are many around the world. And they also discuss the concept of how did we get here? How did they get there? How did they get to that point? Because they've been talking about it for 10 years. And one of the things that they conclude or are concluding is that agencies were unable or unwilling to act. I think it's easy to see that in others. It's harder to see it in ourselves. The one thing that we wanted to make clear is that the board drives this project. We're going to be, as John mentioned, we're going to bring it back to the board on a regular basis and be communicating with you directly and frequently. And we want the board want to set up this process such that the board is driving, and the board determines the scope and the actions that we take and ultimately work on and propose to the board. We don't have resources assigned yet. As we've discussed a few times, we're hiring a lot of staff right now. We're in expansion mode, and because of that, we're restructuring. We expect to be largely settled in that sense around mid-2018. We'll have a better sense of resources we can assign to this project. Discussion is also just beginning, obviously. We'll have the additional scoping sessions. And with that, we wanted to ask you questions. Are we on the right track? You think the scope is reasonable so far? And are we missing anything?
And as ground the questions, and usually I let my colleagues speak first, but I'm going to suggest, and this may help prompt the conversation, that there's a missing link, and that's the link associated with SGMA. I mean, we say sustainable water management, and although State Board and DWR, there is a separation on some of the responsibilities, but there is management plan that have to be addressed by 2020 and 2022, depending on the basins. But I would think that we cannot discuss sustainable water management without somehow acknowledge, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and the agencies, et cetera. So I'll just leave it as that, as a food for thought. So this is, pretty open, and, I'm not going to use left and then right. This is kind of open conversation. So whoever would like to be first, Jane?
Sure. Thank you very much. I'm really happy to see this on our agenda. Don't mean to yell at you all. Thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's long overdue. I just had a question related to the slide talking about groundwater recharge and recycling, and to me there's obviously an intrinsic link between the reclamation of water and then recharging the groundwater basin. So I'm not sure why we're decoupling those, when we're looking at State Board money that went to IPR-GPR studies and moving forward with advanced treatment and how we can make those more actionable in our region.
I wouldn't decouple them at all. I would look for opportunities to leverage all of those efforts and try to leverage them together. So I would not try to decouple them.
I think one had a higher priority, though, in terms of influence and direct authority. And so to me, groundwater recharge should be right up there with recycling.
This slide?
Yes.
So these are in no, on this side, these are in no priority order. They're just up there.
Right, but on the second slide, there's...
they don't connect.
Yeah, they don't connect. So
okay.
I would, what our intent is to pursue direct authority
mm-hmm.
for as many of these in as many different ways as we can think of.
Okay.
And defend.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mayor Delgado?
Yeah, thanks for the clarification, Jane. That was helpful to me and Mike. Talking about SGMA, on page 7 of the staff report, it says under that paragraph at the bottom that the Water Board could consider requiring compliance with SGMA when applicable during the permitting process to make sure the permittees are in compliance. And I think that's a good thing because of the seriousness of the subject, as you've summarized in your presentation. We should use SGMA as much as possible to support that state initiative. Then that the last sentence of that page, it says Central Coast Water Board can encourage use of managed aquifer recharge to provide permit streamlining, and that it's being done all over the world, or at least all over the United States. So I'd like to hear more about that at the future, you know, but that's my input, as I like those too. And then your Department of Finance slide projecting California's population in the future, do you know if that took into account climate change effects and water restrictions?
No, I don't. That's something we've talked about, and when we were preparing the staff report, is that population, a limiting factor is liable to be water supply. So we don't know how that's going to come into play, but I do think it's a limiting factor.
So besides the Department of Finance projection that, well, one, we should probably find out if it's taking that into account. And if it's not, I would guess there's got to be multiple other sources that project our state's population that do take it into account, because I think we should be planning more based on a projection that's more realistic than just one that assumes, you know, water is not a limiting factor. And then on the use of water, you mentioned two primary users, agriculture and urban. In our Central Coast region, are there ballpark numbers that you just kind of keep in mind, that of the 100% of the water used, X percent is urban used and Y percent is ag use?
This is the report that that John was referring to.
So that I interpret that, I mean, in Santa Cruz County, ag gets 98% of its water from groundwater.
Right.
And my question is slightly different, is of the 100% of water used in Santa Cruz County, how much of that is used by urban versus ag, or just Central Coast region-wide? Is there a ballpark figure that staff thinks about? Like, I've heard 85%, 90% ag, 10, 15% other. So is there a general ag use in our and a general urban use percent in our region?
I can't tell you off the top of my head.
That's fine.
But we can look for that and bring the information back.
So aside from what I've mentioned, my answers to your three questions are yes, yes, and no. The last slide, you had three questions. Are you on the right track? You're on the right track. That was the first question. The third question was, did we miss anything? Second question I'm saying yes to, I forget.
Is this a multiple choice?
Yeah,
or what?
Yes, yes, and no.
All right, so...
The questions are back up on the screen.
Okay, so, Jeff?
Thank you. Nice presentation. This kind of maybe takes what Bruce was starting to get into a little bit with groundwater and recharge. And looking at pages 6 and 7, where I'm gleaning my questions from, I think what would be really important in looking at our, you know, the three things we can do, one is what recharge, pollution, and recycling. So I think there's a lot of fruit to bear. Tell me if I'm wrong. In getting more supply from working on projects that are going to capture stormwater and help to get that recharging groundwater. Potential there. I don't know what the numbers are, but I think when we have very large stormwater events and with climate change, where we're going to have possibly more of these big events, we ought to be really reaching out as part of this project with each of our counties and really trying to kind of partner with them, almost whether we have direct authority or not, but to, you know, see where we can kind of work collaboratively to get projects designed and put in the ground. So going beyond just, yes, identifying recharge areas, identifying what can be done to protect them, but actually going beyond that and saying, okay, what can we do to kind of help get some projects in the ground where we're moving stormwater into recharge areas?
Yes.
I think that's would be great.
That part of that is in managed groundwater recharge, where you're capturing stormwater and then deliberately recharging it back into groundwater for future supplies. And some, loosely speaking, some people consider that part of recycling as well, capturing stormwater and using it. Yeah, we're definitely thinking about that.
Okay. I mean, and just to reemphasize it, look how much, you know, your percentages there show how dependent we are in this region on groundwater. And so I just pretty certain we've got groundwater basins that have a lot of unused capacity. Much cheaper to get it into the ground than to build, you know, dams in this area. And I think I would really encourage.
Additionally, that works as a great counter strategy. Enhanced infiltration, boosting infiltration is a great counter strategy against the pollution, too.
Yes.
You know, nitrate, other salts, et cetera.
Yeah.
So from, you know, from my perspective, and I use this as my three-legged stool in regard to Sigma, and again, the linkage to what we're talking about, is that it's about water augmentation, conservation, and innovation. Okay, all three will be key to ultimate success in a sustainable water management program. So when we talk about augmentation, you know, infiltration, certainly on an urban setting, LID is certainly part of it. Last year, there was a lot of conversation about stormwater capturing for agriculture. You know, if we look at the land itself, agriculture, you know, certainly land is one of the opportunities. The other one that has been discussed is healthy soil, you know, the Healthy Soil Initiative. Why? Because of the ability of water retention, you know, high carbon content soil, improving infiltration. So that's another element of it. You know, the other one, I think, addresses the innovations that are available, and innovations available in water treatments where we have tertiary, enhanced tertiary, utilizing reverse osmosis of municipal water rather than reverse osmosis from desalinization, because with desal, your rejection rate of a brine is about 50 to 55% at best, whereas the rejection rate with municipal water treatment is in the 85 to 90%. So that's another area. The other one, which is not as perhaps prevalent within our Central Coast region, but is the rejection water from oil extraction facilities. We've got to remember that in an oil extraction facility, about 80% of the fluid is water. There's only 20% which is oil. So there is a significant opportunity of highly treating that water and then reuse it for beneficial use. So, you know, those are some of the things that, you know, come to mind. I know also, you know, I've had cities talking about, you know, the flange-to-flange opportunity, and they have these visions of sugar and plums from that. Also sometimes, you know, tea-to-tea, you know, which is not as socially appealed terminology, which is translates to toilet-to-tap. But it's more of a direct infill. See, I create a reaction there. So it's more what John was talking about, which is, you know, the direct recharge, you know, with enhanced treatment, which are opportunities. I just, you know, wanted to share those views, but I, in the long term, because, I mean, we're looking at this not as a, you know, one-year effort. I truly believe that, you know, innovation needs to be somehow, some way embedded in this. And although we're the water quality folks, we're not the water quantity folks, but conservation somehow is an integral part, because it wouldn't make sense to work on the water augmentation and yet the conservation is not being part of it. So perhaps there's means there when we talk about, you know, surface water use, runoffs, etc., you know, to kind of link those and address those a little bit. So I know, Jane, you...
That's okay. I mean, I think some of the stormwater stuff is being handled under State Board and the stormwater resource planning that's going on and the funding that's going there. Yeah, there's exactly. This is the second round of grants. So I think some of that is moving forward, and to the extent that we can get plugged in into that process, you know, and get updates on that, that would be really helpful. But, you know, it is storm dependent, and our infrastructure right now is really just not able to deal with those storm events. Yeah. That's the point. Yeah, I understand. Right.
To help facilitate and create more infrastructure so that we can take advantage of those big storm events.
And so I think that's part of the stormwater planning, the SRP, you know, process that's happening now. But yeah, so everything that Dr. Wolf said as well, I completely agree with. So I just think that...
Mike?
Yeah. While it's tempting to say we should do as much of this as possible with direct authority, certainly, as Mike stated, the more we try to do with direct authority, the more work it's going to take to put this together, obviously, in the short term, because we have to justify it. But I guess I'm thinking of some stuff when I hear Jean-Pierre talking about innovation. I mean, I'm thinking of what we're trying to do with the nitrates and groundwater stuff, obviously one of our largest problems in the region. And it's so different than an end of pipe sewage treatment plant problem where we know what they need to do. And we can really use direct authority to, although we're not supposed to say just do this, to pretty much say that. And with nitrate and groundwater, you know, solving that conundrum of how we have a vibrant agricultural industry and don't keep making the nitrate and groundwater problem worse, it just isn't something we have all the answers to. I feel like in the time I've been on the board, I've seen progress. I've seen a lot of work go on and a lot of people trying, you know, creative methods to deal with that. And certainly some of it is all the nitrogen budgeting stuff, and some of it is, I think, stuff that we really haven't figured out yet in terms of some of the treatment stuff. And I guess I feel like I've been thinking about this, and I don't want to, you know, veer off into 4.0, but I've been thinking about this as we think about how we move this forward, that we really need to find ways to incent those stakeholders, to incent ag, who are the ones that have those 10,000-acre laboratories, to experiment. And some of the most useful experiments are the ones that don't deliver positive results, because you learn, right? And kind of the way our regulatory stuff is set up, when the stuff we do just by direct authority is we're telling you what you have to do, and if you want to experiment, that's fine. Just, you know, hit our benchmarks. And we certainly have some legal limits on what we can do, too. The legal limits thing, we've got folks down in the Blanco area of Salinas, where lots of stuff is on tile drains, where people have talked about doing collective constructed wetlands, a technology that actually works, and they want to be able to use the, if you're talking to the farmer, it's the ditch, if you're talking to us, it's the waterway, to move that water, you know, 300-400 yards to the constructed wetlands from the tile drain. Well, you know, we have legal restrictions on being able to allow that. But if we want people to do collective solutions, you know. So I guess I'm thinking that I'm attracted, as well as I think other people are, to things that we do with direct authority, because we really can actually have some more ability to make stuff happen. But I think we have to understand that some of the more effective stuff we need to use with indirect authority as well. You know, we need to find ways, and I don't want to keep coming back to agriculture, because that's not the only that's not the only source of pollution in the region. That's not the only source of opportunity to improve our handling of water by any means, our sustainable use of water. But it's an example that's been so before us. You know, we need to find some ways to use our discretionary powers to incentivize people to experiment, even when those experiments don't always hit our benchmarks. I'm seeing, you know, as I think about this, not just the value of the direct authority stuff, but in some ways there are going to be some kinds of things that we can actually do better with indirect authority.
I want to piggyback just for a second onto that idea. So Mr. Johnson mentioned Blanco Drain. In Blanco Drain, there's a part of a very interesting project going on. Blanco Drain, to some degree, is being plumbed into Monterey One water. So ag tailwater is becoming a water supply by way of that non-traditional relationship developing. That wasn't because we were there. We have to find, and I'm going to kind of steal from the next item, Montecito discussion, and see our role sometimes as facilitators. Maybe that's what you're getting at with sort of the indirect regulation. I think it's actually more nuanced than that. But how do we facilitate that kind of non-traditional relationship from how do we make it happen more often so that waste becomes resource again? You know, and it's solving our problem, too, ultimately, in the case that you brought up, nitrate.
So
how can we incent that?
I'm trying, you know, I'm looking at our time. I want to give the opportunity to the rest of our board members to reflect on this also. So I'll start with Karina and then Monica.
Mine is just very quick, because I did bring this up earlier. I did have just a question about why we had to sort of make explicit that compliance with SGMA, attaching that to our permitting process. And you explained it a little bit to me over the briefing, but I'm still trying to understand what it is that a permittee would have to demonstrate, step up, or show improvement on to sort of meet the permitting requirements along with SGMA compliance.
So when we're thinking of SGMA and managing a groundwater basin sustainably, We're thinking of their overall management of their water portfolio. Groundwater might be the entire thing. It might be one element of their work or water portfolio. So if a community, for example, came to the board and wanted a waste discharge permit, and we looked at how they were managing their portfolio, and if it turned out they were causing saltwater intrusion in their area and that they were not doing any recycling, the permit that they were proposing had no recycling, for example. It was discharged to the ocean. And that they were drawing down their groundwater basin, overdrafting it, and water quality was decreasing as a result. The board might say, we cannot issue a permit under these conditions because it's degrading water quality, the way that the water portfolio, your basin, is being managed. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and you just made it a little clearer that the SGMA didn't always consider necessarily all of the water quality objectives. And I think that that was the question that I had, because I just was operating under the assumption that our permitting meant that they were already complying with SGMA. So I recognize that.
And if it helps a little bit, Karina, at our last chair call that we had Monday, we're considering including SGMA at our WQCC, because all the regions do feel that now that things are settling a little bit about the formation of the agencies, et cetera, this is a topic that will help the regions, you know, to see how we can address SGMA concurrently with water quality, but without, you know, crossing the lines of a DWR set of regulations. So, Monica?
Thank you. Michael, you actually just brought up the point, so nice segue for me, about the situation with ocean discharge. And I know the staff report includes it, in particular mentions it on page 5, and it is really, it's a consideration of recycling rather than discharge to the ocean. But I think because we're a coastal region, the 8 points that are listed there, I think that there should be some statement about the long-term wastewater programs that continue to discharge to the ocean, because it is very, there's some benefits that come from discharge to coastal confluent streams in terms of flow and aquatic habitat. So I think we do need to recognize that we just can't make a blanket statement that eliminating ocean discharge is the goal. It should be considered, though, as part of practices, outdated, archaic practices, where that was the best and cheapest and easiest way to discharge wastewater treatment, effluent. So I would suggest adding a statement there that takes into account the consideration of wastewater discharge to streams that are coastal confluents, where there could be seasonal considerations, I don't know, but some guidance for those coastal cities that still have and aren't moving in the direction of eliminating discharge to the ocean. I don't know where I would like to see probably some linkage to the ocean plan and where they are with it. We could see how we could align or take advantage of any work that's going on, thinking and planning that's going on, you know, more broadly in the state. But I know I've heard many people say to me, why are we still discharging water, or, you know, fresh water to the ocean? And it's a complicated answer, but I think there are places where we could encourage and work to find funding for redesign. Those are long-term transitions for those coastal wastewater systems. But that I think should be articulated as a point.
So this is kind of a nice little segue to another comment that I had and sort of overarching view, which, by the way, we have two speaker cards from Abby and Steve, which will give you the opportunity to, you know, provide some comments as well. But I think we're going to have to think out of the box. So, and sometimes as regulators, that's not easy to do. You know, that's not a criticism, it's a fact. Why? Because we all attended the last WQCC and have, you know, certainly know about the wild swings of weather, you know, feast or famine, so to speak, in the era of water. So we're going to have to kind of think out of the box. And in one example, what is taking place right now. Now, we do have beneficial discharge in streams, which are required, right? And in some streams, it's 1.5 million gallons a day, etc. Well, there's pilot projects being done in collaboration with Fish and Wildlife, where your in-stream flow study have typically been minimum flow study, right? Meaning, what's the minimum flow required to maintain aquatic habitat and, for example, migratory stream to the steelhead trout? Well, there's the other one, which is called maximum flow requirement, meaning what is the maximum flow that maintains the benefit? Above and beyond that, that's excess water that does not add value from an aquatic habitat. So it's basically slicing, another word for the flood stage, using that water and flooding adjacent fields as part of groundwater recharge. And in California, and actually within a region, Swanton Ranch, you know, Cal Poly, that's part of a project done in collaboration with Fish and Wildlife. Now, we're not talking putting a big hose in, you know, in the stream and sucking the water out. Is utilizing riparian shallow well, but being able to pump that water while ascertaining that you maintain the critical flow for habitat. So I think that's an example of a kind of a new way of thinking that, you know, and in some areas, like in the Sacramento Valley, we do have, you know, floodplains, which to prevent flooding, you know, we take that water and then we flood the fields in the winter, and then in the summer, you know, they're used, for example, for rice production. So anyway, I'll stop here. So I would like to ask Abby 3 minutes, and then Steve, you're next. But it's called management by example.
So good afternoon. I'm Abby Taylor Silva with the Grower Shipper Association of Central California. A lot of my comments echo some of the comments that have been made by board members, and they're really pertaining to SGMA. And we made note in the triennial review in our letters and comments that we really wanted this item to coordinate very clearly with SGMA. And so I'm just going to maybe contextualize that a little bit for the Central Coast. I really think that it's important for this board to hear from the SGMA agencies that have been formed. I think maybe a workshop would be really good. You have a lot of diversity in this region. You have Santa Clara and the Pajaro Valley that really only already have their plans submitted, right, because of where they were in the process. You have the Salinas Valley, where we worked very hard. I know I've talked to you a little bit about this before. We worked very hard to form an agency for the Salinas Valley, and we have one in place now that represents most of the Monterey County portion of the Salinas Valley groundwater basin. That to me, is probably, at least in this point in my career, one of those things that I'm most proud of because of the representation of the stakeholders. You have an environmental seat. You have a small community disadvantaged community seat. You have a lot of representation throughout the community. And they are currently working on the beginning stages of their groundwater sustainability plan. Just this week, they've been talking about who they're going to hire. And we'll probably know who they're going to hire in the next few weeks. But what I'd want to be sure of in this discussion is that nothing that's done here on the regional board level kind of inhibits that process. I think that, you know, I was reading the note about encouraging compliance with SGMA. I think if, among my stakeholders, we feel like we're really complying with SGMA, and there's really no alternative than to comply with SGMA. So that what exactly that means, I think we'd want a lot of clarity on, because I think we're already there. And I think within that compliance with SGMA, there are a lot of discussions happening right now about projects, about storage, about water use. And I just wouldn't want to get ahead of that. I would want to work complementarily. So I think having maybe a workshop, having all those different agencies come and talk to you, I will just say I think you'll be impressed by what's happening in the Salinas Valley. And I think it'll help you as you kind of form where you'd like to go in this scenario. Thank you.
Thank you, Abby. Steve?
I'm going to have to speak fast. Steve Schimek with Monterey Coast Keeper. So I've got 3 points that I want to make. First of all, Monica, I really appreciate your comment about, because when you actually look at the water pie from PPIC from, I want to say, about 18 months ago or 2 years ago, basically divided up water into 3 general, very general uses, domestic uses of water and urban uses of water, agriculture, and the environment. There was a statement made, I remember it from a couple years ago, where somebody stood up and said 50% of the water pie is environmental water, and so when we look at the water pie, really agriculture and really urban isn't the general use, it's the environment. I actually dove into the PPIC studies, and I actually called the PPIC authors, and when they broke it down by water use by region, actually the Central Coast had 0 environmental water that was allocated. 0. And you could look at the PPI study and see that. That's kind of sad. So that's the beginning point that I want to make. And the secondary point to that is a lot of your beneficial uses are tied to that environmental water. And so if you have no environmental allocation, you are ignoring many of the beneficial uses. The second point that I want to make is about recycling and exactly using CSIP and the Blanco as an example. There is no evidence whatsoever that recycling to anything less than a groundwater recharge level and putting that water back in the ground represents a diminished use of water. When you get to the Central Coast in Monterey County, if you look at that example in particular, what you see is that water gets recycled, and then that water gets reused in that same industry to enlarge the use of that water. As an example, if you look at all the agriculture and the movement to drip irrigation, the recycling of the CSIP water and turning it into agriculture, but then you look at the amount of agricultural water used, it does not go down. What does happen is the amount of irrigated acres goes up. And so we're talking about an allocation problem. And as that water gets recycled, it gets reallocated back into that use. The final point I want to make is the point I made earlier, which is an easy basin plan change that you could make, is that discussion of setbacks and making sure that you have at least 50 feet protection of of riparian and riparian protection. You get both pollution benefits, groundwater recharge benefits. We need to protect our riparian areas, and it's unclear in the current basin plan. Thank you for the extra few seconds of time.
Sure. And I need a clarification from you to help me understand. You said that in the Central Coast there is zero beneficial environmental allocation?
Well, not beneficial, environmental allocation. Yeah.
Well, if you take the 1.3 million mandatory discharge in San Luis Creek, which is earmarked for steelhead habitat.
Right.
Give you just another quick one, you know, and I don't want to go over the whole long list, but Lopez Lake, 2.5 million gallon a day because it's a steelhead trout stream. You know, there's another slice which is for agriculture benefit, you know, in terms of the groundwater pumping, but it sounds like it's more than zero.
Actually, I would agree with you. Because I also look at things like the Big Sur River. I actually look like at some of the other streams that obviously have environmental flows.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going by the PPIC report and the words of the PPIC authors. And that's what they say. I actually think that if you actually look at, if you actually use common sense like you do, like you and what I'm suggesting I am also doing, it's not zero.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would also say that it's de minimis in comparison to the other uses.
I just agree with you. There's, you know, we have all kinds of water releases for, you know, biological habitat and for fish. So I think we just need to be careful when we're throwing out numbers that we're accurate.
I would be more than willing to provide you with a reference to the PPIC.
Well, I'm not questioning the reference. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we know the facts. Yeah. So anyway, I appreciate you know your input and also the fact that you recognize that sounds like the authors, you know, may need to.
I think the general point is accurate that it's probably de minimis in comparison to the other uses.
All right. Thank you, Steve. So I'd like then to close this item.